Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
Rain began to fall from a steel-gray sky, bringing with each drop the scent of ozone. It mixed and competed with the sulfurous stench of burnt gunpowder, the reek of thousands of unwashed bodies, and just a hint of blood on the air. Thunder rolled, drowning out the occasional crackle of cannon, handguns, and the twanging of bowstrings in the distance. Some of the droplets fell onto a prominent white turban. It crowned a sallow, lined, exhausted, and unhealthy-looking face, featuring a sharp, prominent nose above a red beard. The face's owner did not seem well, and appeared far older than his actual age, which was in the mid-40s. Years of strain and toil had worn him down. He grimaced at a pain in his leg. The effort of remaining upright on his magnificent gray horse was almost more than he could bear. But his eyes retained their fire and spark, an unrelenting intensity and will. Their owner's name was Mehmet, and by now, he had ruled the Ottoman Empire for nearly 3 decades. Those eyes, hard and narrowed, drank in the sights in front of him. His janissaries, professional slave soldiers loyal to the Sultan, herded a gaggle of defeated prisoners toward their master. The prisoners were Italian mercenaries in the service of the Republic of Venice, the garrison of this minor but strategically valuable fortress in the craggy mountains of Albania. Stained with mud and blood, half-starved and thoroughly defeated, the mercenaries looked up at their captor. Mehmet had promised them mercy if they surrendered. But now he had changed his mind, irked at their refusal to give up the moment he appeared with his army. The Sultan had spent lives and resources to force them into submission. They would pay with their own. It was only fitting. Mehmet spat a few words in Turkish to the Aga of the Janissaries. They forced the prisoners to their knees, pulled thick, curved-bladed swords from their scabbards, and set to work. Precise, well-practiced blows cleanly separated the mercenaries' heads from their bodies, spraying their blood into the Balkan mud. Mehmet watched, nodded his approval at the Aga, and slowly turned his horse away from the headless corpses. No emotion clouded his face. He had witnessed thousands of executions, and at least these Italian mercenaries had died well. Mehmet couldn't say the same for every death he'd seen. And Mehmet had seen plenty of death, from his conquest of Constantinople to Serbian fields to the mountains of eastern Anatolia to this muddy Albanian fortress. He was Mehmet the Conqueror, not loved, but feared. A sultan whose name would echo through the ages. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The Ottoman Empire doesn't get enough attention in general, and definitely not in discussions of the history of the 15th or 16th centuries. In large part, that's because we know how the story ends, with a long, slow decline, becoming the sick man of Europe in the 19th century, and then eventual annihilation after the rise of nationalist movements and the chaos of the First World War. But the Ottoman Empire was the most powerful state in its part of the world throughout the 15th century. In the 16th century, it became a global power, an empire that nearly overwhelmed its European competitors and strangled them in the cradle before their ascent to world historical importance. Under the leadership of Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Empire spanned 3 continents, extending from the Straits of Gibraltar to the Persian Gulf. If a few things had gone just a tiny bit differently, the sultans might have gone further still. So with that in mind, we're going to spend the next run of episodes talking about the Ottomans. The key thing to understand is that despite the conception of the Ottomans as deeply foreign, a capital O other, separate from Europe proper, the Ottomans were in fact a constituent part of late medieval and early modern Europe. They were a constant factor in European politics, directly as both allies and enemies, and indirectly as a variable whose attitudes and concerns had to be constantly weighed and evaluated. Their military resources were enormous in comparison to any individual European kingdom, including a vast artillery train and a cutting-edge army of professional soldiers, the Janissaries. The Ottoman Empire's economy was vast, encompassing everything from subsistence farmers and pastoralists in the uplands of Anatolia to some of the richest merchant cities in the Mediterranean, all of them connected by trade to the European and the Asian economies beyond. All of this is a roundabout way of saying that the Ottomans weren't some foreign interloper in European affairs. They were first and foremost a European power, and they were part of Europe's broader trends in this period. We can't understand Europe without understanding the Ottomans. We've talked a little bit about the early years of the Ottoman Empire here on Tides, from its humble beginnings in the 14th century to the epic conquest of Constantinople in 1453. That was a dramatic moment, the culmination of more than a century of expansion, and an encapsulation of the organizational and cultural genius the Ottoman regime had painstakingly built, decade after decade after decade. It was also the moment when Christian Europe was forced to grapple with the undeniable reality of an expanding, dangerous Muslim state right on its Balkan doorstep. It's not a coincidence that one of the first things Gutenberg printed in 1454 was a pamphlet exhorting Christian Europe to take up arms against the Turkish menace. Constantinople had stood as a Christian city for more than a millennium. Even in its somewhat pathetic, reduced state, it had been the bulwark of a still-existing Byzantine Empire. Now, it was gone, soon to become the capital of an expanding Ottoman Empire. A 21-year-old sultan with even grander ambitions turned his attention still further to the west. Today, we'll follow the rest of Mehmed II's remarkable career. While the conquest of Constantinople was the beginning of a new phase of Ottoman history, it was the end of another. And we need to briefly run through what came before in order to understand what came after. Mehmed II, the conqueror of Constantinople, was the seventh official sultan of the Ottoman dynasty. Over the course of 150 years, from the beginning of the 14th century to the conquest of Constantinople in 1453, the Ottomans had transformed themselves from minor warlords on the fringes of the Islamic, Byzantine, and Latin worlds into a major power. That was already a remarkable accomplishment, and it laid the foundations for their further growth into a genuine world empire. Anatolia, Asia Minor, the westernmost projection of Asia opposite Greece and the Balkans on the other side of the Aegean, was a wild place at the dawn of the 14th century. It was basically a frontier zone, a patchwork of Greek-speaking Orthodox Christians, some Latin crusaders and merchants from the west, the Turkish Seljuk Sultanate, and the edges of the great Muslim powers of Syria and Persia, and the reborn Byzantine Empire of Constantinople. A whole lot of Turkic-speaking nomads, many of them recent arrivals from the Central Asian steppe, fleeing Genghis Khan and the Mongols, complicated the picture. This was a land of diversity and contrasts. Turkish pastoralists moved their flocks, tents, and carts from one remote high pasture to the next. Venetian and Genoese galleys plied the coastlines. Crusader castles that wouldn't have looked out of place in southern France commanded key strategic points. Greek Christian peasants worked their fields and tended vines and groves of olives, just as their Greek-speaking ancestors had done for centuries. Persian merchants and Egyptian Mamluks traveled roads that had originally been built by Roman emperors. Anatolia was a haven for warlords, mercenaries, and holy warriors, a land of opportunity for anybody with military skill and flexible politics. Bands of Turkish nomads might find work as soldiers for a petty Byzantine despot looking to one-up the neighboring city one year, then work for the Seljuk Sultan the next, and then a Venetian merchant colony the next year. Turkic warlords, called emirs or begs, ruled tiny polities in the hinterlands between the larger powers, building up territory, losing it, and fighting all the while for glory, power, plunder, and faith. There was no particular reason to expect any of these Turkish warlords to found a state or a dynasty that would last especially long. But one of them was both talented and lucky. His name was Osman, and he was the founder of the Ottoman dynasty and the empire that went along with it. According to tradition, Osman ruled from 1302 to 1324. We say according to tradition because there isn't a single document from his reign that we can fully authenticate. But what we know about him fits neatly with this wild, dangerous, unstable frontier world that he inhabited. Osman was basically a local frontier warlord operating in the region of Bithynia, northeast of Constantinople, and he was far from the only guy meeting that description at this time. But Osman was successful, and Bithynia was full of opportunities. It was close to Byzantine territory, which could be profitably raided and plundered for precious objects and slaves. Glory and wealth and religious conflict attracted followers, and the Turkish tribesmen of Anatolia flocked first to Osman and then later to his son, Orhan. It was Orhan who stepped up the Ottoman game, first capturing the city of Bursa in 1326 and then Nikaea in 1331. That was a big deal. Nikaea was a major city of the Byzantine Empire, second only to Constantinople itself. This was the first real sign that the Ottomans were a cut above their competition in the world of petty Turkic warlord polities in Anatolia. On top of that, Orhan defeated a Byzantine army in pitched battle. He conquered the Anatolian coastline of the Aegean, and he expanded deep into central Anatolia, toward what's now the Turkish capital of Ankara. But Orhan's most important move was inserting the Ottomans deeper into Byzantine politics. He married the daughter of the Byzantine emperor, and it was in the context of a Byzantine civil war that Ottoman soldiers, carried by Genoese ships, first entered Europe. Once established there, the Ottomans would be impossible to permanently dislodge. Their roots were in Anatolia, and they remained a force in that westernmost extremity of Asia. The eastern frontiers, with a variety of fractious, warring emirates and powerful states like the Ilkhanids of Persia and the Mamluks of Egypt, were always a concern. But what's key to remember is that the Ottomans quickly became a European power. It's where their greatest opportunities for expansion were. It's where they focused most of their expansive energy. And it's where the desire for plunder, glory, and religious fulfillment brought the Ottomans so many capable followers. By 1370 or so, the Ottomans had firmly emerged. Their rulers were talented, but there were lots of skilled, ruthless warlords in this region. What made them such a force? The Ottomans were unusually flexible in adopting ideas, practices, and institutions. Existing tax structures and land arrangements from the Byzantine territories they conquered, Seljuk and Ilkhanid central bureaucracies, the Persian-tinged court culture common throughout the Muslim world from Algiers to Delhi. Slave soldiers were an old concept in the Muslim world, and the Ottomans adopted them, too, in the form of the fearsome Janissaries. But the Ottomans were also innovators. They developed a practice called the devşirme, a forced levy of recruits from Christian subjects throughout their lands to supply recruits for the Janissaries. The other levied slaves went to work in the Sultan's household. In either case, these slaves belonged personally to the Sultan and formed a core of supporters who were exceptionally competent and completely loyal to the ruler. So many of these Turkic polities were torn apart by conflicts between their rulers and their powerful Turkic aristocracies. Conflicts of this kind weren't absent in the Ottoman state, but the Sultan's personal slaves, called kapikulu, who populated his household and the Janissary Corps, gave him a powerful counterweight to those centrifugal forces trying to pull them apart. Two other things set the Ottomans apart. The first was their embrace of holy war, Gaza, as a fundamental component of Ottoman identity. Raiding and plundering in Christian territory wasn't just a chance to gain military glory and material rewards. It was the fulfillment of a religious duty. This was tremendously prestigious for the Ottoman rulers and a great inducement to the pool of talented Turkic warriors in Anatolia who could be drawn into their service. The second thing was dynasty. Where many of these other small polities would be divided among a ruler's sons at his death, the Ottomans never did so. The ruler's potential heirs had to fight it out until there was only one left. Now, that could be tremendously destructive, lethal, and wasteful. But this practice, called unigeniture, ensured that Ottoman territories remained a single, constantly growing unit. This was the Ottoman formula, and it propelled them to victory after victory after victory. Murad, Orhan's successor, took the key city of Adrianople, northwest of Constantinople in Europe, and made it the Ottoman capital. armies under the Ottoman banner advanced into Greece, Albania, and then Serbia, where they won a crushing victory at Kosovo in 1389. This victory cost Murad his life, but his son, Bayezid, proved to be every bit a worthy successor. Bayezid had his brother Yaqub strangled in his tent on the battlefield to secure his position as sultan, and then set about expanding further. By 1394, when the Ottomans first laid siege to Constantinople, they controlled much of Europe south of the Danube River, including the northern Balkans, much of Serbia, along with all of western Anatolia. Constantinople and southern Greece were islands in an increasingly Ottoman sea. Disturbed by the growth of Ottoman power, a crusade of mostly French and Burgundian knights met a crushing defeat at Bayezid's hands at Nicopolis in 1396. Only an equally crushing defeat in 1402, dealt by the world-spanning conqueror Tamerlane, held Bayezid back from taking Constantinople and expanding still further into Europe. Timur captured Bayezid, who left behind five sons to compete for the rule of the Ottomans. The result was an 11-year civil war that nearly destroyed the Ottoman state for good. The man who emerged victorious from that chaos, Mehmed I, spent the entirety of his reign dashing from one potential disaster to the next. Rebellions in Europe and Anatolia, incursions from the Turkic state of Karaman to the east, a campaign against Wallachia on the Danube, until the stress and strain of a lifetime took its toll. Mehmed's son, Murad II, succeeded him in 1421, and he too spent the entirety of his life at war. Against Turkic emirates in Anatolia, the Venetians, the Byzantines, Hungarians, Wallachians, rebellious vassals in Europe, and crusaders from still further west. His janissaries killed and beheaded the king of Hungary and Poland, the 20-year-old Władysław, at the Battle of Varna in 1444. Murad II too died relatively young, aged about 47 in 1451. Ruling the Ottoman Empire was a draining, exhausting, murderous task, and not just for the Sultan's enemies, most of whom tended to end up dead. Murad's son, Mehmed II, was a highly intelligent, well-educated, and ambitious young man, only 18 years old when he took the throne. His first attempt at ruling hadn't gone especially well. His father had tried to retire, only to be recalled amid a Janissary revolt and a crusade from the west in order to save the day. But even at 18, given a second chance, Mehmed had an incredible will to power, a sense of destiny, and a willingness to turn all the resources of his vast territories toward the task of conquest. That task began at Constantinople.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Cannon boomed. Mines, burrowed under the walls of Constantinople by the constant scratch, scratch, scratch of picks and shovels and then filled with gunpowder, exploded in cascades of dirt, stone, and rubble. Handguns crackled and bowstrings twanged. Above it all rose the chorus of war cries, yells, and the screams of the injured and dying. Watching it unfold was the 20-year-old Ottoman Sultan, Mehmed, who had brought tens of thousands of his vassals and slaves, all the resources of a vast and powerful empire, to the meeting point of Europe and Asia for one last attempt to conquer the city. Who was this young man, the would-be conqueror? A sharp, aquiline nose defined his face, hanging over full lips and a reddish-brown beard. A thick neck jutted downward, sitting atop a large, strongly built frame. A Venetian observer said of the youthful Mehmet, "He burns with the desire to dominate." Ambition defined him. His mind was keen, well-educated, blessed with tremendous natural intelligence, curiosity, and a gift for languages. He spoke Turkish, Persian, Arabic, Greek, a Slavic dialect, and a bit of Latin. He studied history, geography, and engineering with fierce concentration, obsessively gathering information on military strategy that he could put to practical use. Having grown up the least favorite son of a distant and world-weary father, Mehmet was under no illusions about the challenges he would face as sultan. Deception came easily to him, secrecy even more so. He could be surprisingly magnanimous and generous, seemingly out of nowhere. But at the same time, his capacity for incredible brutality was already apparent. He had publicly beheaded a group of Venetian sailors and impaled their captain for the crime of attempting to run his blockade of Constantinople in 1452. And that was just a taste of what he could do. The blood of thousands upon thousands stained his hands, executed in the cruelest imaginable ways, ranging from burning alive to being fed to wild animals to the more common impalement and beheading. His subjects would never love him, despite all his accomplishments, but they feared him. So did Christian Europe. On May 29, 1453, Mehmet and his Ottoman soldiers broke through Constantinople's ancient walls, killing the last Byzantine emperor, along with thousands upon thousands of his subjects and foreign mercenaries. Constantinople, one of the centers of the Christian world for more than 1,000 years, was now the Ottoman capital of Istanbul. This was the event that earned Mehmet his sobriquet the Conqueror, and it sent shockwaves throughout the Christian world. The implication was clear. Ennio Silvio Piccolomini, Bishop of Siena, a dedicated humanist and the future Pope Pius II, wrote the following to Pope Nicholas V on July 12, 1453, after hearing the terrible news. Quote, "Already the sword of the Turks hangs over our heads. Already the Black Sea is closed to us. Already Wallachia is in the hands of the Turks. Thence they will invade Hungary and then Germany. Meanwhile, we live in discord and enmity." The sense of dread, despair, and inevitability hung heavy throughout Christian Europe. A papal bull of 1454 attempting to launch a crusade compared Mehmet to the red dragon of the apocalypse, the precursor of Antichrist. Meanwhile, Byzantine refugees poured into the ports of Italy, carrying their knowledge of ancient Greek and crates full of precious manuscripts. This was more fuel for the intellectual fires of the Renaissance. The Genoese refused to believe the news at first. The Venetians quickly got over it, writing a fawning letter to Mehmet and securing normalized trading relationships. The king of Naples and Aragon, Alfonso, grandly promised to lead a crusade, but he was unwilling to endanger his several thrones to do so. Gutenberg's press pumped out copies of the Turken Kalendar, the call for a crusade, but nobody went. Mehmet, as the future pope had immediately grasped, was far from done. He was just 20 years old, with the entirety of Christendom laid out before him. Nearly 3 decades of ceaseless war lay ahead. And ceaseless isn't an exaggeration. Almost every year between 1454 and 1481, when Mehmet died, an Ottoman army was raiding or fighting somewhere between Anatolia and Italy. The empire Mehmet inherited was full of contradictions. It was both extremely centralized around the sultan's household, packed full of slaves collected on border raids or through the Devşirme, personally loyal to Mehmet himself and the Ottoman project. At the same time, however, it was deeply decentralized. Mehmet only controlled large swaths of his empire, like Serbia, through powerful, semi-independent vassals. Loyalty and soldiers were the price of admission. Thousands of Serbs fought for Mehmet at the Siege of Constantinople, but they often operated without much oversight. The border lords, some of them ethnic Turks, others Christians, carried out their own raids and wars and pursued their own conception of their relationship with the Ottoman Sultan. In other words, this was less a matter of top-down control than a constant power negotiation between the Sultan at the center and the border lords on the periphery of the empire. Their goals weren't always the same, neither were their interests, and reconciling them was an ongoing struggle. That was the built-in structural tension of the Ottoman Empire. The way to bury those inherent structural tensions, Mehmet knew, was through successful and constant military expeditions. Even if he had wanted to stop with Constantinople, which he didn't, the Ottoman state practically required expansion to remain viable. More plunder, more slaves, more territory. These were the grease that lubricated the potentially grinding gears of the Ottoman system. This is a key point, so bear it in mind as we move forward over the next few episodes. This dynamic, the necessity of conquest, was a constant in Ottoman history. Mehmet's first order of business after securing Constantinople was Serbia. Technically, Serbia was a vassal state of the Ottomans, ruled by an 80-year-old political survivor named George Brankovic. Brankovic hadn't made it to his age by picking a single side and sticking to it. Instead, he played everybody, looking for allies and the best possible deal. Usually, that meant the Ottomans. Hence the Serbian cavalry and specialist miners at the Siege of Constantinople in 1453. But Brankovic had also been playing footsie with the Hungarians. Mehmet had had enough, so early in 1454, he sent emissaries demanding direct control of a large chunk of Serbian territory. When Brankovic fled to Hungary, Mehmet led one army into Serbian territory himself and sent two other forces led by subordinates. It took several years, an open war with Hungary, and a siege of Belgrade in 1456 was a major setback at which Mehmet himself was injured. But by 1459, practically all of Serbia was under Mehmet's direct control. Tens of thousands of slaves, a huge amount of plunder, vast amounts of new territory to be distributed to vassals, and rich silver mines all came into Ottoman possession. At the same time, Mehmet's forces were expanding into mainland Greece and the islands of the Aegean. This wasn't unfamiliar territory. The Ottomans had taken Thessalonica in 1430. Raiders regularly entered Greece. Several of its petty lords were already Ottoman vassals. That last piece provided a pretext for further Ottoman involvement, and in 1458, an army entered the Peloponnesus, the southernmost part of Greece. Aside from a few lonely Venetian outposts, the entirety of Greece fell under Mehmet's control by 1460. Mehmet didn't forget about Anatolia either. The western half of the peninsula mostly belonged to the Ottomans, but there was still a strip of territory along the coast of the Black Sea that wasn't in their possession. One piece belonged to the Genoese, and they surrendered without a fight. The next, Sinope, belonged to a Muslim lord, and it too surrendered without a fight. The last holdout was the city of Trebizond. Once Constantinople had come into Ottoman hands and the small-scale despots of Greece had fallen, Trebizond was the last remnant of the Byzantine Empire. It too fell in 1461. Wallachia, ruled by the infamous Vlad Draculia, Vlad the Impaler, was next in 1462. Wallachia was a border zone between the powerful Hungarians and the Ottomans, already geopolitical rivals in this part of the world for the better part of a century. For generations, going back to before the Crusade of Nicopolis in 1396, Wallachia's rulers had played their two powerful neighbors off against each other. Rule surged back and forth between noble factions and lines of princes, supported first by the Hungarians, then by the Ottomans. Changes of allegiance were common. Vlad had come to power as an ally of the Hungarians, but soon paid the required tribute to Mehmet. In fact, Vlad and his younger brother Radu had spent their boyhood as hostages of the Ottomans. Radu may have even had a sexual relationship with Mehmet, whose tastes were reportedly quite varied. When Vlad quit paying the tribute in 1461 and then impaled an Ottoman delegation sent to negotiate with him, Mehmet decided to replace him with his brother. Seizing the initiative, Vlad invaded Ottoman-held Bulgaria and carried out a brutal campaign, complete with still more impalements and nailing an Ottoman envoy's turban to his head. In response, Mehmet personally led an army into Wallachia in 1462. Vlad led a night attack on Mehmet's encamped army, aimed at killing or capturing the Sultan, This clash at Targoviste became famous as a great victory for Vlad, but in reality, it was a failure. The next day, Mehmet continued onward into a tableau of insane violence. Quote, he, Mehmet, marched on for about 5 kilometers when he saw men impaled. The Sultan's army came across a field with stakes, about 3 kilometers long and 1 wide. And there were large stakes upon which he could see the impaled bodies of men, women, and children, about 20,000 of them, as they said. The combination of Vlad's cruelty and obvious Ottoman power made the choice easy for the Wallachian nobility, who accepted Radu as their ruler and kicked Vlad out. Vlad spent the next 13 years as a prisoner in Hungary. If you'd like to know more about Vlad, I did a whole episode on him back in 2018, and it's worth going back and listening to it if you're interested. Eastern Europe at this time is a fascinating part of the world that doesn't get nearly enough attention. So, the next year, 1463, saw 2 major developments. First, the conquest of the Kingdom of Bosnia, and second, the beginning of the largest conflict of Mehmet's reign, the 16-year war with Venice. We recently did a couple of episodes on Venice, and in the second one, we covered Venice's unique seaborne empire, the Stato di Mare. Now, as the Ottomans were expanding over the course of the 14th and the 15th centuries, so too were the Venetians. Between 1380 and 1420, the Stato di Mare more than doubled in size, mostly at the expense of the wheezing, contracting Byzantines. In these circumstances, conflict with the Ottomans was inevitable. The two sides first clashed over control of the key port of Thessalonica in Greece between 1422 and 1430. The Ottomans came out ahead in that conflict, and mostly peaceful trading relations continued over the next few decades. Constantinople's Venetian community fought hard against Mehmet in 1453, and Venice sent a half-hearted relief effort that never arrived, but the Venetians also sent a fawning letter of congratulations to Mehmet in the aftermath of his victory. In Venice, trade was king, and nothing could stand in its way. War, though sometimes necessary, was bad for business. As a result, the Venetians avoided war with the Ottomans for as long as they could, until Mehmet's relentless expansion finally left them with no other choice. It was bound to happen at some point, and during the Bosnian campaign, a minor issue over the Venetian refusal to return an escaped slave turned into the pretext for all-out war. It had been brewing for a while, and the war party within Venice had finally had enough votes to force the issue. Armies of skilled Italian condottieri, well-paid and experienced mercenaries, landed in Greece and made real headway against the Ottomans. At the same time, the Venetians supported resistance to Ottoman attacks along the Adriatic coast, especially in Albania. The Ottomans had a fight on their hands. The Venetians knew the Ottomans well. Nobody had as many spies and put as much emphasis on information gathering as the Venetians. They also knew the importance of diplomacy and set about concluding treaties not only with the Hungarians, but also with the Muslim rivals of the Ottomans far to the east in Anatolia. While the Ottomans were a European power, and a growing one, they also looked to the east, and that dynamic would define them for centuries to come.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Anatolia was still a frontier zone, albeit not nearly as wild as it had been in the heady days of Osman back in the 14th century. But the Ottomans still weren't the only game in town. One of their great rivals was the Emirate of Karaman in southeastern Anatolia, west of the line of the Taurus Mountains. Whenever they could, primarily when the Ottomans were busy in Europe or during the civil war that traditionally accompanied the death of a sultan, the Karamanids raided and made war on their more powerful neighbors. The Venetians tried to ally with the Karamanids as a way of putting pressure on the eastern flank of the Ottoman Empire, but the Bey of Karaman soon died, leaving behind a messy succession dispute. Luckily for the Venetians, they soon got an even better ally, Uzun Hasan, the ruler of the powerful emerging Akkoyunlu Empire, spanning much of present-day Iran, Iraq, and eastern Turkey. The Akkoyunlu, also known as the White Sheep Turkmen, were yet another of the states born of the meeting of Islamic state building and nomadic pastoralist military muscle. The cooperation between Uzun Hasan and the Venetians was never tight or particularly useful, but it did produce a key strategic dynamic, a two-front war for Mehmed, who could never campaign in one direction without having to worry about and devote resources to what was happening 1,000 miles away. Even with all the resources at his disposal, Mehmed's capabilities weren't limitless. In 1465, for example, Mehmed's exhausted troops simply refused to follow him on yet another ceaseless expedition, no matter how significant the rewards and plunder and glory might have been. Other rulers might have halted to recover strength, but not Mehmed. Simply bided his time, weathering a few slight Venetian victories in the west while he campaigned actively in the east. Finally, in 1470, Mehmed turned his full attention back toward Venice and its stronghold of Negroponte, the long island off the east coast of Greece in the Aegean. It was Venice's key port and trading stopover. It allowed them to project naval power into the Aegean and the eastern Mediterranean, which made it a threat to the core Ottoman territories. Mehmed spent thousands of his soldiers' lives, but succeeded in capturing Negroponte. He ordered every man and boy above the age of 10 executed and had the women and children sold into slavery as punishment for their defiance. That was Mehmed's way. Efficiency, brutality, and an unstinting will to power. And still the wars went on. Ottoman raiders advanced deep into Venetian territory along the Dalmatian coast and kept up the pressure. This forced the Venetians to spend enormous sums of money on mercenaries and fortifications. In the process, this created one of the greatest zones of military innovation in the closing stages of the 15th century. Uzun Hasan, meanwhile, created trouble in the east, spurred on by the promise of Venetian aid against the Ottomans. The Venetians even landed cannon on the shoreline for Uzun Hasan to pick up and use against Mehmed, but the Akkoyunlu ruler never collected them. Finally, in 1473, Mehmed turned his attention toward Uzun Hasan. In a devastating battle in eastern Anatolia, the Sultan's gunpowder handguns and artillery blasted Uzun Hasan's army of horse archers, winning a decisive victory. That was the end of the Akkoyunlu as a threat to Ottoman power, and Uzun Hasan himself died in 1475. For now, at least, Mehmed's far eastern flank was secure. But even as Mehmed was winding things up in the east, the situation in Europe was growing more complicated and difficult. A major assault on the Venetian-held port of Shkuder on the Albanian coast failed in bloody and costly fashion in 1474. The voivode of Moldavia, Stephen the Great, had driven Mehmed's ally Radu out of Wallachia, turning a stable Ottoman ally into a trouble spot. The Ottoman army sent to deal with Stephen the Great met another bloody defeat early in 1475. Meanwhile, tensions with the powerful Kingdom of Hungary, led by its highly competent king Matthias Corvinus, were heating up. The rivalry between Hungary and the Ottomans went back decades. Hungarian crusaders had died at the Battle of Nicopolis in 1396. Mehmed's father's janissaries had killed and beheaded the King of Hungary at the Battle of Varna in 1444. The Hungarians' great power machinations in Wallachia had put Vlad the Impaler on the throne and then removed him. The Ottomans and the Hungarians were a constant factor in the other's political calculations. The Pope and the Venetians both tried to enlist Matthias Corvinus in their war with the Ottomans. For much of the time, however, Corvinus had other concerns, namely trying to grab the crown of Bohemia for himself and fighting against the King of Poland. But finally, Corvinus was forced to deal with the Ottoman threat head-on. Ottoman raiders had crossed the Danube into his territory and ravaged it, carrying off thousands of slaves. Other Ottoman forces had entered Croatia, going as far as Habsburg territory on the fringes of Austria. Corvinus had no real choice but to make war on Mehmed, and luckily for him, concern about the Ottoman advance was growing widespread in the West. Now, Corvinus was nobody's fool. In fact, he was one of the most gifted of an outstanding generation of late medieval rulers who came to power in the second half of the 15th century. Had he devoted himself to fighting the Ottomans instead of warring incessantly with his Christian neighbors, he might have been Mehmed's great rival. Corvinus maintained a standing army of professional mercenaries, the Black Army, which was right on the cutting edge of European warfare, complete with cannons and handguns. When Corvinus turned his attention to fighting the Ottomans, he did so with aplomb. He invaded Ottoman territory in the Balkans late in 1475, besieging and capturing the fortress of Sabac early the next year. This was a powerful message about what he could do, but he quickly turned his attention back toward his relations with Christian Europe. Ottoman raiders still penetrated deep into Hungarian territory in 1476, passing through Croatia and into the southern reaches of Austria. These were less invasions than large-scale plundering expeditions organized by the Turkish frontier lords of the Balkans. Mehmed was determined to deal with the Moldavians rather than Corvinus, gambling, correctly, that Corvinus's dislike of Venice and concerns with Bohemia, Poland, and the Holy Roman Empire would keep him busy elsewhere. Mehmed was aging now, plagued by gout and the lingering effects of old injuries. He had campaigned everywhere, from Wallachia to Albania to Serbia to the southern coast of the Black Sea to the easternmost reaches of Anatolia, logging thousands upon thousands of miles on horseback. He had taken an arrow to the leg outside Belgrade, nearly died in battle on several occasions, overseen thousands of executions, presided over the sacks of cities and the building of mosques. Now, although he was only in his mid-40s, he seemed much older, worn down by the cumulative strain of decades spent in unceasing war. But Mehmed still had a bit left in the tank. He led his army into Moldavia and forced an open battle with Voivode Stephen. As his troops faltered, Mehmed spurred his horse forward, shield in hand, inspiring his janissaries to win a hard-fought victory. After just 10 days of rest, Mehmed was informed that the Hungarians were on the move. One Hungarian force briefly placed Vlad the Impaler back on the Wallachian throne, where he met his much-deserved end after a few weeks. Another Hungarian army entered Serbia, and Mehmed drove his exhausted, half-starved army west into Serbia to meet the new threat. The Hungarians retreated, and finally, after more than a year in the field, Mehmed returned to Istanbul. The war against Venice dragged on and on, at an increasingly exorbitant cost to the beleaguered city. In the autumn of 1477, Ottoman raiders got to within 30 miles of Venice itself, lighting fires that could be seen from the iconic campanile of St. Mark's Basilica. Quote, "The enemy is at our gates," wrote a Venetian to the Doge. "The axe is at the root." Ironically and fittingly, the expedition that came so close to Venice was led by a man named Iskender Bey. Iskender was the son of a Genoese merchant and a Greek woman. He had converted to Islam and risen to become Sanchak Bey, administrative commander of Bosnia. As Mehmet's forces advanced into Christian territory, the talents of many former Christians powered the Ottoman drive. Mehmet was prone to executing subordinates who displeased him, but there were rewards aplenty for the dedicated and the successful. Iskender Bey was far from alone in this. Mercenaries, fortifications, ships, and supplies were costing Venice the staggering sum of 1.25 million ducats per year, several times the annual revenues of even the incredibly wealthy trading city. That was far more than it could afford. In 1478, Iskender Bey once again raided into Venetian and then Austrian territory. The Ottomans again laid siege to Shkodër. While they failed to take the key Albanian port, the pressure was more than Venice could bear. The Venetians were determined to make peace, whatever the cost. It cost them a huge upfront payment and an annual tribute, but they had bought the respite they so desperately needed. With the Venetians out of the way, the Ottoman border lords turned their attention back to the Hungarians, plundering huge swaths on the Hungarian side of the Danube. Only a massive defeat at the hands of the Hungarians in October 1479 put a temporary, and only temporary, end to Ottoman raiding. What the Venetians knew to their dismay, but the rest of Europe wasn't nearly concerned enough about, was that Mehmed had no intention of stopping his warring after securing peace with Venice. His ultimate goal had always been not the Dalmatian coast, but Italy itself, and more specifically, Rome. Those incursions into Istria and Friuli, at the head of the Adriatic and within sight of Venice, were just the beginning. As far as Mehmed was concerned, his conquest of Constantinople made him the legitimate heir to the Roman Empire and gave him a claim on Rome itself, not to mention the former Byzantine territories of southern Italy. Mehmed was an Ottoman emperor. He was also a student of history. The legacy of Rome and its successor states wasn't limited to the popes and the Holy Roman emperors. Already, by 1475, Ottoman soldiers were chanting Roma, Roma as part of their battle cry, and Mehmet had intended an Italian invasion for decades. His interest in Italy went back as far as his adolescence, even his childhood. Italian painters came to his court. Now, with Venice sidelined, the opportunity had finally arrived. The Venetians, angry at the lack of help from their Italian compatriots and the Pope during their long, desperate war, may even have secretly aided Mehmet in this endeavor. It was only 46 miles across the Straits of Otranto from Ottoman-held Vlore to Apulia in southern Italy. Early in the summer of 1480, a substantial Ottoman force made the crossing. Some 18,000 men, including a large number of crack janissaries and a substantial artillery train, landed just outside the port of Otranto. The Ottoman commander, Gedik Ahmed Pasha, quote, extremely cruel, debased, and corrupt, according to a Christian chronicler, offered the city the opportunity to surrender unharmed if they didn't resist. The citizens of Otranto refused, and Gedik Ahmed Pasha promised them, quote, fire, flame, ruin, annihilation, and death in return for their defiance. Ottoman cannon, the finest in the world, blasted holes in the walls and made short work of its pathetic defenses. As Gedik Ahmed Pasha had promised, the entire male population was put to death. The archbishop was killed at his altar. Some 800 captives were beheaded when they refused to convert to Islam. Using the ruins of Otranto as a base, the Ottomans fanned out into the countryside of southern Italy, pillaging and burning with their customary efficiency. Some 8,000 freshly captured slaves were loaded onto ships and sent across the straits to Albania. Otranto would serve as a brand new foothold in Italy, the springboard for the conquest of the entire peninsula, just as Mehmet and his predecessors had rolled through Anatolia and the Balkans. Beset by internal divisions, Pope Sixtus IV's efforts to put together a pan-Christian crusade to dislodge the Ottomans came to nothing. Edward IV of England wanted nothing to do with it. Louis XI of France, the universal spider, negotiated only slowly. The Holy Roman Emperor Frederick had nothing to give. Matthias Corvinus made token contributions, but he was busy elsewhere. The Venetians flatly refused, having fought for 16 years with no help from the rest of Christendom. And then, quite suddenly, at this moment of greatest danger, Mehmet died. He had been unwell for years, beset by a terrible abscess in his leg, gout, and the effects of years of hard living. He was just 49, but looked much older. A surviving portrait of him at this time conveys little but the sense that he was drastically unwell. He had gathered his army in the spring of 1481 and set off for the east, probably to follow up on an unsuccessful siege of the Hospitaller Knights of St. John at their island stronghold of Rhodes. A few days out from Istanbul, Mehmet had died. Perhaps it was the gout that finally got him. Maybe it was poison, since Mehmet had so many enemies, including his son and likely successor, Prince Bayezid. Whatever the case, Mehmet was dead. Chaos broke out. The Janissaries, rebellious as ever when deprived of the Sultan's leadership, murdered the Grand Vizier and carried his head through the streets of Istanbul on the point of a spear. Civil war between Mehmet's sons, Bayezid and Cem, was inevitable. Only this respite saved Italy and Christendom from at the very least years of raiding and warfare. Mehmet had conquered Constantinople, finished off a semi-independent Serbia, secured Albania and the Dalmatian coast, brought Venice to its knees, and humbled the Akoyunlu of Persia. He had spent his entire reign at war and killed tens of thousands of foes, not to mention thousands of his own subjects. He was feared and respected, never loved. Now he could finally rest. So too could the neighbors of the Ottomans. They breathed a sigh of relief after 30 years of financial expenditure, military pressure, and incredible violence. Mehmet the Conqueror was done, but the Ottomans were far from finished. Next time on Tides, we'll be continuing the story of the Ottomans with the struggle between Mehmet's sons, Cem and Bayezid, and the growth of the Ottomans into a power, not just in Europe, but in the Middle East as well. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.